You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place!
This is a Hendrix song. I was never a Hendrix guy. Can't dance to Hendrix unless you're totally wasted. It's one of those drug-induced head bobbing, smashing events. Since I didn't do drugs, how do you do it? But you two kind of cleaned it up. It's got a beat. All right, let me read you a couple emails, and then I want to get back to the subject of the Hanoi Hilton, right? Vietnam era prisoners of war, specifically those at the Hanoi Hilton, had a 4% rate of post-traumatic stress. Somebody explain that to me. So I'm going to get an explanation, okay? That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for an explanation. So we'll get to that here in a second. Okay. And here's an email. I had never heard that statistic before, Mac. That's astounding. I would think, if anything, how does confinement like that, how does abuse like that not create a basket case? I'm anxious to hear the interview done by Brian Lamb, who always did good stuff. It's a pity he no longer does that job because he did it so well. The other guy, when I think of Brian Lamb, and I think of credible media people, I think of Tim Russert. His loss was our loss because Russert seemed to have a way to get after both sides in a respectful way. Doesn't seem to happen much these days. I agree. Media people. And it seems like if you don't play the partisan game, then you don't get any reps. And this is entitled Norks, I guess, which means North Koreans. Mac, did I just read that Little Rocket Man is in the process of releasing 3 U.S. prisoners? This news about North Korea is almost too good to be true. I'm being cautiously pessimistic. That's what Newsom advised us to be. But my heart is telling me that we are on the precipice of witnessing something that will be talked about for centuries to come. What a time to be alive, bro. You know, again, that's my sentiment. Like, I'm with you. I'm feeling the cautiously pessimistic thing. But what my heart is telling me is something else. It's like, okay, every time we say that, he does something else to say, yeah, that's he does something else that says that that's not going to be the way that it is. He does something else that, and even Newsom said, well, if he begins releasing American prisoners and they talk about opening up the prisons, he keeps doing it. He keeps pulling our punk card. We keep wanting to be pessimistic, and he keeps saying, oh, that's what you want? Okay. So, yeah, the president evidently alluded, to that in comments he made earlier today. There was a White House event, I want to say it's National Prayer Day. And so the president made comments that somewhat insinuated that that there was possible release pending. So, again, yeah, I don't. I don't. Beyond that, it's speculation. All right. Trump hits a likely release of three Americans held in North Korea. Rudy Giuliani did the same thing. All right, so there's a series of comments that have been made, and the most recent is about an hour ago. There were unconfirmed reports on Thursday that North Korea has moved U.S. nationals from prisons in the isolated communist country to a hotel in or near the capital ahead of an expected meeting between Donald Trump and North Korea Kim Jong-un. U.S. officials have not confirmed that the three men are out of North Korea's notorious prison camps, but Rudy Giuliani, who recently joined the White House legal team, told Fox News on Thursday that the North was, quote, releasing three prisoners today. It was not immediately clear whether Giuliani had confirmation that U.S. citizens' release was imminent, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Thursday that while we think that would be an incredible sign of goodwill and certainly a great statement for the North Koreans to make ahead of the summit and discussions, she could not make any announcement about U.S. detainees. And this is from the president yesterday. As everybody is aware, the past administration has long been asking for three hostages to be released from a North Korean labor camp, but to no avail. Stay tuned. That is from the real at real Donald Trump. So, yeah. So again, I think cautiously pessimistic, but again, we'll see. We'll see. Not to get ahead of, let's not get over our skis there, boys and girls. Let's not get over our skis. Okay, the next piece of audio, Gunner's teaching a firearms class today. That's why he's not going to be here. But I wanted to play this because I'm intrigued now. Why such a low incidence of post-traumatic stress in people that ought to have it? Hell, there's only 13 minutes left in the program. Well, we're going overtime today, boys and girls. All right. Here's what you're going to hear. This is Colonel Lee Ellis, United States Air Force retired. He was an F-4, right? Phantom pilot in Vietnam. Okay. He was on his 53rd combat mission over North Vietnam. And that was just over North Vietnam. He had an additional 25 or more over South Vietnam. He was shot down. He spent 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. He was on C-SPAN. And about a book that he wrote. All right. The book is entitled Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. So, and this was done in January of 2014. So, without further ado, and again, it's very interesting. These guys as a group went on to do great things. How? Given the fact that everything that we know about, you know, prolonged exposure to this kind of abuse should lead these guys to become basket cases, should lead these guys to become victims. But it didn't. Why? All right, so we're gonna learn. So without further ado, this is Colonel Lee Ellis, United States Air Force retired.
At 4 o'clock, what happened?
That's Brian Lamb. Okay, so we just asked him on a certain date.
Lee Ellis, go back to November 7th, 1967, at 4 o'clock. What happened?
I was on my 53rd combat mission over North Vietnam. I had another 25 or so over South Vietnam and Laos. And that day we rolled in on gunners that were protecting the Quang Ky Ferry. We were working with a F-100 Mystic Pack that had called us in and said, hey, I need you guys to put some bombs on these gunners down here. And so we rolled in to do that. There were two of us in the F-4 Phantom. The airplane was hit right after the bombs came off the airplane at a fairly low altitude, 4,000, 5,000 feet. But unusually, the airplane just burst into several pieces, and we were tumbling in over end. I knew that the airplane wasn't flying. The stick was frozen aft, smoke in the cockpit. I couldn't communicate with my partner in the airplane. We had two pilots in this airplane. I knew I had to get out, and I was well-trained. I'm about to eject over enemy territory that we've been bombing for a couple of years, but there was no other choice, so I pulled the handle. Everything worked automatically, perfectly. It blew the canopy. It blew me about 50 feet in the air and separated the seat from me, which automatically pulled the D-ring, which actuated the parachute. So the next thing, in less than 2.5 seconds from the time I pulled that handle, I'm checking my parachute. There's a lot of shooting going on the ground because they're shooting at our wingman, and this is just a nest of guns, anti-aircraft artillery, and a good number of militia down there because it was protecting a strategic target. So a lot of shooting going on, but the wonderful training that I had in the Air Force and the military does a great job of training. I was unfazed by the fact that I was over enemy territory and they were shooting and I could hear the bullets go by. I was checking my parachute. What was really on my mind was evading capture. And there was a river about 200 meters south. I thought if I can get to that river, I've got a little life raft. I'm only a mile and a half from the Gulf of Tonkin. If I can make it there, the Navy will pick me up and I'll go home. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough altitude to slip my parachute. Those old parachutes didn't slip very well to guide, and so I had to do a parachute landing fall. So that's what I did, and it took them a couple of minutes to capture me. I actually did make a radio call for the wingman. I said, this is Buckshot 2 Bravo. I'm on the ground. I'm 200 meters south, north of the river. Start strafing at 300. I'm headed south. After the war, I met with those pilots that were in those airplanes, the wingman, and I said, they said, well, we heard your call, but we decided not to strafe. We didn't think we could shoot that accurately. And I said, probably a good call, because they were all around me, and within 2 minutes, they surrounded me and captured me.
How many times had you flown over North Vietnam?
53.
What was the purpose of each of those flights?
Our particular base, which was at Da Nang in South Vietnam, the northern part of South Vietnam, about 70 miles south of the DMZ, had been flying all of the missions over North Vietnam, all types of missions. But about a month after I got there in the summer of 67, they changed our mission to fly only armed reconnaissance over the southern part of North Vietnam. So we were flying the Ho Chi Minh trails, the main highways and riverways to try to stop the trucks that were hauling the supplies into South Vietnam to the Viet Cong and to the North Vietnamese soldiers who were operating in South Vietnam.
How old were you?
Well, I was 23 when I got there, and about 2-3 weeks before I was shot down, I turned 24.
What was your rank?
I was a first lieutenant.
And who did you travel with in the same, you're in an F-4?
Right.
Who was with you?
A guy named Ken Fisher. Now, I had flown with various guys. In fact, I was, because I'd flown 53 over North Vietnam, I was one of the more experienced guys, so I would fly with some new guys that would come into the squadron to check them out and the local procedures of flying combat in North Vietnam. But that day I was flying with a guy named Ken Fisher. Unfortunately for him, unfortunately for me, I guess, but fortunately, I couldn't have had a better guy with me because he was a guy of great courage, mental, physically strong, great character, and he ended up being an incredible leader for me.
Where is he today?
He's retired in Tampa, Florida, playing golf.
How close are you today?
We're very close. We don't get to see each other and play golf enough, but we're very close.
So what happened when you hit the ground? And where were you at that point?
Okay, I'm 200 meters north of this river. It's kind of a floodplain, bushy area, low scrubby bush, that no trees, but scrubby brush. I did a parachute landing fall, just like the paratroopers are taught to do, and we had been taught to do. I hit all the points, so I had no injuries from the parachute. I did have some injuries from the coming out of the airplane. The straps hit me in the mouth and the back of the head and that sort of thing, but not serious. So I'm immediately thinking about evading. That's why I made the call to try to get them their heads down so I could escape, but that didn't work. So here they are coming in, closing in on me. I'm still thinking evade. And when I went through SEER school, survival school, they taught us that the people who capture you are probably the least trained to capture POWs and maintain them. And so your best time to escape is right then. So I thought, okay, these are rookies. So I pulled out my .38 combat masterpiece. I had 2 rounds of tracer and 3 rounds of ball. And I went like this, get away, get back. And then I fired a round of that tracer right over their head. They didn't flinch. They just raised their rifles like this, and one of them reached in his pocket and pulled out a little pointy talkie, which was like a little comic book they carried. Some of them carried in their pocket. It had drawings on one side and Vietnamese phonetics on the other. The drawing showed them capturing an American pilot in his uniform with his helmet on and a parachute, and he's got his hands up. And this one guy said, "Surrender, no die. Surrender, no die. Hands up! Hands up!" So here I am facing about 9 long guns staring at me. And I decided that's probably the best advice I was going to get that day. So I went, hands up. They didn't shoot me, and they pounced on me and began stripping everything away.
What was your level of fear?
I didn't really have any fear. I wasn't aware of any fear. I'm sure I did because my adrenaline's going, you know. I didn't notice fear until they started stripping everything, all my clothes off. And then I think as they pulled the survival vest off and they couldn't get it, they didn't know much about zippers, so they just started cutting. So I was afraid it was going to get cut. But I think it was every article of clothing they pulled away, my survival vest, my G-suit, and then my flight suit. I had more fear as I lost each piece of clothing, that by the time I got stripped down to my jockey shorts, I was probably in shock.
Where was your co-pilot?
He landed he was the aircraft commander. I was like the co-pilot in this particular airplane. It was, back then we had 2 pilots in this airplane. And he was a captain, and I was a first lieutenant, so he was a senior guy. He landed about half mile away. And the gunners, actually, the people on the ground, actually, he never did his parachute landing fall. They caught him in the parachute before he hit the ground.
So a couple of quick things.
Mm-hmm.
How many years were you in a POW camp?
5 years, 4 months, and 2 weeks.
How many different camps were you in while you were in North Vietnam?
5.
What was the first one you went to?
Maybe 6, actually, counting the one that we were in on the way, kind of a halfway house. We called it a halfway house or a holding station. It was a bamboo barn building-like place with little bamboo cages in it where they kept us until they got a few people enough to haul in one truck, and they put 4 of us in the back of the truck and hauled us on into Hanoi. Generally, we were hauled in, tied up in the back of trucks.
And what was the first prison you were in?
The holding plant camp was Vinh, and then from there I went straight to the Hanoi Hilton with these 3 other guys.
And where was the Hanoi Hilton?
It's in downtown Hanoi. It's a French-built prison built in the early 1900s, a bastille, 15-foot high walls, 5 feet thick, embedded broken wine glass on top, with electrocution wires around it and guard towers at all the corners.
We have some video that shows the outside of it. This network went over there in 1992 on a POW MIA trip of Senator John Kerry, Senator McCain. You can see this on the screen there. Mm-hmm. What we weren't allowed inside it, but if you were inside this, how many cells were there, and what did it look like?
Well, it was like being inside part of it was like walled prison, and well, there's the you see the broken bottles on top of the wall there, and the electrical wires around it. Inside, it was like a compound inside walls, and so there were various sections. There were 2 large buildings in the the top in one corner. Then there's a whole cell block that would hold about 200 POWs in another area, and then there was a larger part of it that had 7 large cells where there were Vietnamese prisoners for several years. Later, they emptied them out after one of the camps was raided, and they put 330 of us, all the POWs just about that were up in North Vietnam, back into the Hanoi Hilton, the Wallow Hanoi Hilton, all back into those 7 rooms where the Vietnamese prisoners were in. When they got scared that the U.S. might raid downtown Hanoi, they moved those Vietnamese prisoners out and put us right in there.
We have some video of Robbie Reisner. I'll ask you about him after we see this, because that's the main reason that you're in town.
Right.
Let's watch.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine being shut off from all communications, even in your prison environment? It won't work. You become stupid and dumb, I guess. Well, integrity, loyalty was another thing. We were loyal as we could be to each other. It meant a great deal. For myself, and I think everyone will tell you the same thing, we found out we loved our country more than we had ever imagined. The flag meant a great deal to us, more than we had assumed. And our faith in God came to have a great deal of meaning to us. I didn't know a single man over there that didn't pray.
Who was he?
Robbie Reisner was Lieutenant Colonel Robinson Reisner. He'd been an ace in the Korean War. That means he shot down MiGs. He shot down 8, I think. So he was a hotshot pilot. He was probably one of the more famous pilots in the U.S. Air Force. He'd been on the cover of Time magazine in April 1965. Then he was shot down and captured in September 1965. In October of 1965, they realized that he was the senior. They knew that he was famous. They realized they had somebody famous. They realized that he was exercising leadership as the senior ranking officer in the camp, and so they came after him in a big way. And that's when the really big bad torture started, was in October 65. So when I got there 2 years later in November 67, he had been the reigning senior ranking officer. We called it SRO, the commander of all the POWs up there. And what an incredible leader he was. He was an inspirational leader, but he was a tough leader. He led by example. And like Denton and Stockdale and other great leaders, they always went first. They pulled them in first for the torture, thinking if they could break them, that we would follow. But Reisner always bounced back. All of them did. And that was what was so amazing about this experience, was seeing this extraordinary leadership, the courage that enabled them to lean into the pain of their fears and just keep doing the right thing to the very best of their ability.
I use the term, who was he on purpose, mm-hmm. The reason for you being in town.
Right.
What is it?
He died about 6 weeks ago, and we're having his funeral at Arlington tomorrow, January 23rd.
What did he do for the rest of his life?
He came back and continued with his Air Force career as a brigadier general in the tactical flying world. He was an inspirational leader. He retired. In Texas, he was head of the Texas War on Drugs for a while and just served in civic positions and did a lot of speaking, traveled all over the world speaking as a motivational speaker for many years, both to the military and other organizations, Christian organizations, various organizations around the world. I knew him. I met him in the camps. He was really the first American that I was able to communicate with face-to-face. It was covert, but he provided inspiration. He had just come out of 10 months in total darkness. His book is called The Passing of the Night, and it was about the passing of that long night of darkness that he was there. He was in solitary confinement, as were Denton and Stockdale, for more than 4 years of his POW time. But we usually had covert communication, a lot of that.
What does that mean?
Covert, we were not allowed to openly communicate with other cells. And when you're in solitary confinement, you know, they even want more to have you isolated so you can't, nobody can encourage you and build your morale. You can't have teamwork. They did not want him to exercise leadership. So they had him in solitary confinement an awful lot. But we would take great risks. We would risk torture. We'd risk our lives to reach out and connect and communicate with people in that way. So he was so encouraging to me, gave me some basic guidance. You know, resist, take torture up to the point of losing of having permanent mental or physical damage, then give in, give as low as possible, bounce back, stay in the communications, pray every day, go home proud. And out of that, we had our motto, which was the best mission, vision, value statement I've ever seen. Three words: return with honor.
So when you think back of your first couple of months in a POW prison, what's the first thing you think of?
Being scared and cold. It was wintertime and it was very cold and hungry and scared because we started having interrogations, and it wasn't long before we had to, you know, put our foot down and say no, and they wanted me to fill out a biography. I refused. We went through torture. I went through torture. My other cellmates went through torture for that. And they were threatening us. Every cell had a speaker in it. And three times a day, we had propaganda. Every cell in North Vietnam that we were ever in, except for one in the mountains near the end of the war that had no electricity, every cell had a speaker. Three times a day, we got propaganda. They thought they could convince us they were right and we were wrong. But part of in those early years, they were threatening us that if we did not have a good attitude, which meant agree with them and make propaganda for them, then we were going to suffer and we might not ever go home. So I didn't believe they could keep us there. I didn't believe the U.S. government would let them keep us there. But on the other hand, you know, these were communists desperate to win their cause and to be victorious. So I didn't know what they would do.
So explain what it's like to be cold and why were you cold?
Well, this, as I said, was an old Bastille prison. The walls were 16 inches thick, concrete floor, fairly high ceiling, and in the wintertime there's no heat. In the summertime there's no air. So in the wintertime, if it was 55 degrees outside, it was 55 degrees inside, plus damp and cold. And that's not very cold unless you don't have any real warm clothes. You know, I had no socks. We did have a couple blankets. We had one blanket, and then we got another one in that first winter. But I had two pairs of thin pajamas and a little cotton sweater, and that was it. So it just always seemed cold. In the middle of the night, I would wake up about 4:30 in the morning, cold, hungry, hadn't eaten since 4 o'clock the previous day. It just seemed cold.
What kind of food were you, sir?
6 months of pumpkin soup. We got fed twice a day, about 9:30 in the morning and about 4:30 in the afternoon. 6 months of pumpkin soup, thin, watery soup, not much pumpkin. 3 months of cabbage soup, then cabbage soup, and always a little pig fat in there. And about 3 months of what we call sewer green soup, which is kind of like chopped up lily pads. Also, we'd have either a cup of rice, small cup of rice, or a small baguette of bread to go with it. And the bread, really, mostly we had bread if the trucks were coming in from China or Russia or wherever the wheat came from. They liked the rice themselves, and they gave us the the wheat and the bread, and that's probably what really helped us a lot, because it had some important nutrients in it, and it had some protein in it. And that was the only protein we got in those early years. No meat.
Let me read from your book. Around 6 a.m., a new interrogator entered the room and ordered me to complete the form. You were talking about the biography form. When I refused, he told the guard to stay with me and beat me whenever I moved out of the stress position. Around 8 a.m., I dropped to the floor, too exhausted to remain in position. The guard began kicking and hitting me with increasing intensity. Finally, I yelled, "Bow cow," indicating that I wanted to speak to the officer in charge. You go on to say, "It was probably the lowest point in my life. My fatigued and aching body bore little resemblance to the strong, brave image I formerly had of myself."
Mm-hmm.
How did they torture you?
Well, they had different ways, but that particular day, that was the what we call the humane torture, in that they made you torture yourself in a position of stress, on your knees, with your hands over your head, in leg irons. And, you know, after hours and hours of that, your just body just starts quivering and shaking, and you just can't do that anymore. So you'd fall over and get some rest, and I was able to do that for quite a while until he put the guard on me. They would catch me, and I'd put my hands back up. And then we'd go through round after round of this, and finally they put the guard on me just to stay with me. And they were determined one way or another. They were just going to escalate until I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And so that's what I figured out, and that's what I did.
How often were you tortured, and how much weight did you lose?
Well, the next time was about 2 or 3 months later. They wanted me to read on the camp radio, and it was a similar type thing. I probably lost close to 20 pounds in those early years. I went in at about 155, 160, and I was down to about 130, 35 probably.
How sick were you at any time?
I stayed pretty healthy. I did get like the flu a few times, and we had one time that pink eye went through the camp. We had jaundice and hepatitis went through the camp, and a number of guys got that. And then we had a little bit of typhoid fever. We had one cellmate die. I had one cellmate die from typhoid fever just a few months before we came home. It was just one of those fluke things that happened. He got typhoid fever and didn't make it.
You talked about a speaker in every cell.
Mm-hmm.
I want to run some video and ask you whether or not you ever heard this person over that speaker.
You're listening to, that's Brian Lamb's voice you just heard. He was for years a fixture, the guy at C-SPAN, Mr. C-SPAN, if you will. And he is doing an interview with Colonel Lee Ellis, who is a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton. Colonel Ellis wrote a book called Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. And we're listening just out of curiosity. 4% rate of post-traumatic stress among prisoners, and he spent 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. How? How does that happen? And what lessons are there for the rest of us?
I don't want... There is war between the Vietnamese people and the Americans who are sent here to fight the war. So we think it's just not right. So I just want the GI to resist this fighting, that they don't take part in the fighting. Of course, it's difficult for them because they are sent by the government, but... our work is to make them believe that the war they are fighting is not just. It's against the Vietnamese people. The Vietnamese people want their country to be free, so they should not be here, the American GI.
Hanoi Hannah. 1992, somewhat after the war.
Mm-hmm.
She actually told me after the interview was over that her son at that moment was in San Francisco, I think either working or going to school.
Mm-hmm.
What impact did she have?
Humor. She provided humor. I mean, for us, we're pretty well educated. I'm the youngest guy in the camp at 24. And most of the guys, the average age is 30, pretty well educated group. So... she would say, "GIs, why are you dying 10,000 miles from home? And in a war that does not matter for you, Why are you attacking the Vietnamese people? So we heard this every day. So she occasionally provided some good humor for us when she mispronounced words, you know, English words. Like, for instance, she was reading a list of people that had been killed in action, those who died but not for the fatherland. And she had one person who was from Chicago 3. Now, this was back when Illinois was abbreviated ILL. So she read it as Chicago 3. So we got a little laugh out of that one. And then one time she was quoting someone who was anti-war or something about the war. And she said, and a middle-aged lady from Detroit said. And so that became, anytime you really wanted to have some fun in the cell and we had somebody to talk to, and they'd say, well, how do you know that? And you say, well, I heard it from a middle-aged lady from Detroit. It has to be true. So we turned those things into humor.
What did the Vietnamese do to the prisoners of war that worked?
The prisoners of war that...
In other words, you know, some propaganda effort, mm-hmm. some torture effort that had a negative impact on
worked.
It.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you meant work.
I mean,
we didn't really get to do
it
anymore.
If you look at the lessons for the future when you this would happen, what would you suggest works?
Well, there are very few people who actually sided with them in our circles. There were like four or five, okay, out of 400, let's say. So, you know... 1%.
You're talking about American military people who sided with them.
Yes. Is that what you're talking about?
Well,
you're talking about the guys on the battlefield.
Go ahead with that line, because I know I wrote down Lieutenant Colonel Mentor, who you talk about in your book.
Yeah, those. I think some of those guys were just they were not sound inside about who they were, and when they got in that situation and they were afraid, they reverted to survival. And they were just taking care of themselves to survive and go home. So they rationalized that, we shouldn't have been in this war in the first place. And some of them remembered some of the teaching at some of the universities where they'd been. It was fairly anti-war international relations classes, U.S. imperialist type stuff they'd heard in classes. And they put it all together with the propaganda, and they said, we shouldn't have been here in the first place. Well, you know, that's fine if you're on the streets in Chicago or Washington, but when you wear the uniform, you can't just change your mind because you get captured. You know?
What about this Lieutenant Colonel Mentor? What happened to him in the camps?
Well, he was a senior ranking officer in that first cell. That first cell in the Hanoi Hilton we were in was 6.5 by 7 feet, and there's four of us in there for 9 months. And one of them was this Lieutenant Colonel Mentor. And within a few months, we noticed that he was starting to talk like them more. More and more, he was starting to sound like Hanoi Hannah and some of that stuff, but a softer version, but agreeing with them that we shouldn't be there and the bombing was maybe not the best thing and all this kind of stuff. So here I'm a first lieutenant looking a lieutenant colonel in the face and saying, I don't think you should be talking that way and I don't think you need to be thinking that way and so on. Well, one day he wrote out a 8 or 10 page description of how some of the military operated in his world. And so Captain Ken Fisher, who was my front seater, the guy I was flying with, the second ranking guy in the cell, later when he was out of the room, when Mentor was out of the room, Fisher said, hey, I think I should take command of this cell and relieve him of command and give him an order to obey the code of conduct. Will you support me? We said, absolutely, that's the right thing to do. So when Mentor came back in the room, he relieved him of command, gave him an order to comply with the code of conduct and quit collaborating with the enemy, to which Mentor said, well, you know, this is not a declared war, and it's really every man for himself, and I don't think the code of conduct applies.
So what happened to that relationship in that cell from then on?
Well, it was kind of icy. It was because we just had to tolerate and live and let live, and until we, about 4 months later, we separated. We went to another camp, and he did too, and we never saw him again, although we did hear from other POWs that he continued to collaborate and even ratted on them for communicating with each other. He was they put him in a key corner room where the communications, the covert communications, had to go around his corner to go down the other hallway, from one hallway to the other. And rather than help, he ratted on the guys for communication.
Is he alive today?
I would assume so. He was a few years ago.
So you all didn't have any more to do with him after that?
No. We tried to court-martial him, but the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Secretary of Defense and the political leaders decided that was not in the best interest of the country, that the war was over, and if we court-martialed him, then it would be a trial of the war that would go on, and some of the movie stars with a lot of money would pump money into his case, and it just wasn't worth it. So they gave him a letter of censure and retired him.
Here's some video from our trip over there in 1992. John McCain is in our studio back here, but get your reaction to this.
John McCain, this is the cell where Mr. John McCain was being kept.
How long, did you know?
Still a man in the world. Some from the day from... Because I was not in charge of American pilot prisoners.
Was he here by himself?
Thì cái nguyên bản của nó ấy, nó chỉ khác có như thế này nhé, tôi biết. Vì tôi về thì tôi cho cải tạo. Tất cả cái này vẫn nguyên này.
Này. Edit a bit. First of all, the windows were all bricked over, so the only ventilation came from some small holes near the top.
So when he said that window had been there with the bars on it, that was not true.
It had been there with the bars on it, but they had just bricked it over, put bricks on it, because they kept us isolated and they didn't want us to see or communicate with each other. Second of all, there was never any bomb shelter that I saw during the two and a half years I was in that prison, nor did we ever go to any bomb shelter, because then we would have had to, obviously, be together, and they didn't want that to happen.
He wrote the foreword for your book.
Yes, he did.
What was your relationship with him?
We got to know each other in the last few months when we went back to that camp before our release, after the agreement was signed in January of 73. And they lined us up in camps by shoot down and capture date, because that's the way they were going to release us over a period of 2 months in groups. Every couple of weeks, they released about 100 to 120. So he and I had been shot down and captured 11 days apart. And so we were right in the same group. So we were together in that camp. But then they had opened the doors and we got to walk around the courtyard and be together. So we walked and talked for a couple of months before we came home. And then afterwards, we remained friends over the years and worked together on one of our reunions. I coordinated one reunion. He coordinated the next one. So we coordinated with each other. And we see each other at reunions occasionally. And I've been to his office maybe once a year up here in the last few years, just stop by and see him. And he was kind enough to write the foreword to the book.
How often, looking back on, first of all, how many total POWs were there during the war?
There were about 650 total at the end of the war that came out of Southeast Asia, of which about 500 were air crews that were up in the Hanoi area, and of those, there were about 350 that were there for more than 5 years. There's kind of like two groups. There's people who were there longer than 5 years, and then remember the bombing stopped in the spring of 1968 and didn't resume for 2 or 3 years. So there's a big gap in there when there were really almost no POWs coming into the system. So we're sitting up there with no bombing going on, wondering when is somebody going to take some action to get us out of here. But that's how there's kind of two groups, the old group and the newer group.
How many died in captivity?
I don't know, but of the ones that I do know about, there are 9 who were alive in our circles that died and didn't come back. A couple of them were tortured to death. A couple of them got very ill, that sort of thing. And then there were 2 or 3 that we think died right after capture that were just tortured, or the local populace killed them before they got to Hanoi. And then there are others that maybe have been in Laos or other places that we don't know about. You know, we don't know what happened to them.
This next video is a man who ended up as a senator, United States senator, after he was a POW, and I'll get you to talk about him.
Okay.
On February 12, 1973, Denton was released from prison along with numerous other POWs. He was a spokesman for the first returning group of POWs. And as he stepped from the plane, he was asked to make a statement on behalf of the group.
We are honored to have the opportunity to serve our country under difficult circumstances. We are profoundly grateful to our commander-in-chief, and to our nation to this day. God bless America.
God bless America.
Where were you around the time that that happened? Had you already touched down?
No. I was still sitting in prison in Hanoi. We came out in four large groups. The first one came out, I think, February the 12th, I think, was that one. And that was the old guys who'd been there 7.5 years, 8 years, Everett Alvarez, 8 years, and Smitty Harris, about 8 years. And some of those guys, 7.5, 6.5 years, that's who that group was. And Denton, of course, had been there 7.5 years, and he was a senior ranking officer on the first airplane to touch down. And so he gave the first words by an American POW coming back. And probably couldn't have been a better guy, because he's a gifted speaker and had gone through, had done great leadership and courageous leadership over those years, been in solitary confinement for more than 4 years. But a good spokesman for us, I think, and I think that worked out well.
Explain what solitary confinement really means. What would it be like if all of a sudden we were in solitary confinement? What would the atmosphere be like in a day be like?
You'd be all alone, except when the turnkey opened the door with a guard with him, with a rifle, and opened the door and lets you empty your bucket in the morning. That was your bathroom. It was a 3-gallon bucket with a lid. And then about 9:30, you would open the door and you'd pick up your bowl of soup and your bread or rice and water, a liter and a half or so of water in a little pitcher. And then about 4:30, they'd open the door and get your food again. Oh, they would come back by and open the door and pick up the metal bowls and spoons and have someone wash those. Another POW would be washing those usually. And other than that, it would be an interrogation, and which wasn't a good thing. So, which happened depends on what you're in solitary for and how long you're going to be there, but that could be fairly often for a guy like Reisner or Denton.
Was there a light on in the cell?
Yes. The general rule was there's one light bulb hanging down from the ceiling, not a real bright light. Rooms are typically very dark except for that one little bulb, and sometimes I think they turned those off in the daytime, which made it even darker in there, but they always burned all night long.
Did you have a chair in there?
Never sat in a chair except at an interrogation for 5.5 years.
Why?
There were no chairs. POW cells don't have chairs. You sit on the floor or the edge of the wooden... either concrete slab or a wooden slab that you slept on. I never sat on a chair.
When you were in a cell
interrogation. Well, and then it wasn't, I never sat in a chair then. It was a stool, like a little milking stool, so that our heads would always be lower than the interrogator's head, who was sitting in a regular chair, and we're sitting down on this little stool, so we're lower, which in their culture, I guess, meant they were more important.
You talk in your book a lot about the value of your religion in this atmosphere, and so did Robbie Reisner.
Right.
Explain how important that was.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a very strong Christian home. Went to church every week, Sunday school, church. My family read the Bible and prayed, so I had a really strong foundation of faith.
Where were you from?
Georgia. I grew up on a farm outside of Athens, Georgia, in near a little town called Commerce, where I went to school. Poor farm in that the dirt wasn't very good. My mom taught school, and so I had all the adventures of growing up on a farm, which was great. But faith was, you know, when you're alone, well, first of all, as a fighter pilot, you know, you're pretty confident, cocky. You're in control. You can do anything, all that sort of stuff. But when you're depending on your enemy to keep you alive and to feed you and have a roof over your head, you know that you're not very powerful. And so it puts things in a different perspective than here in America, driving down the freeway in your nice car and or being in your home with heating and air and all that and hot water. I never had any hot water. Didn't have any ice cubes. You know, you don't have anything just but the basics. So my relationship with God was very important, and so it was a lot of prayer. Everybody prayed. Even in a room of four guys, we didn't sit there and talk all day. I mean, there were times when, you know, there might be total silence for 30 minutes or an hour, and just waiting for the next event to happen. And so people, or you see somebody's obviously sitting over there in meditation and prayer, and you just shut up so you don't disturb them. So there was a lot of that going on. We asked for a Bible all the time. They wouldn't give us one. And, of course, the communists didn't like religion. We knew that.
But you did say once you got a Bible, somebody wrote it down and memorized it?
That was, well, some of us had memorized some verses before we went in, so that we passed those around through our communication system and memorized more. But after Ho Chi Minh died, and the American National League of POW/MI families got organized, they really, the POW families, put a lot of pressure on the North Vietnamese about our treatment. Ho Chi Minh died. The new leadership came in.
69.
Say again?
1969.
69. And they put a lot of pressure. The new leadership came in, and with this pressure, bad publicity, which they didn't like, the new leadership decided to improve our treatment. And they cut out most of the day-to-day torture, all the day-to-day torture, and it just was rare for somebody to be tortured after that, and basically went more to a live-and-let-live policy. And during that regime, we kept asking for a Bible, and finally, they would allow one guy from the cell to go out on Saturdays. And by this time, we're in a big cell. This was after a raid on one of the camps, and we're back in the big cells, 55 guys in a cell. One guy could go out, or two guys could go out and copy from like a chapter out of the Bible for about 45 minutes. They could copy on a piece of paper and bring it back into the room, and then we would share that. And then on Sundays, in my cell, we had we had one guy in charge of church service on Sunday, and his job was to get a speaker. So it was interesting. There were some fabulous short homilies there in that cell from these grisly old fighter pilots, you know, and it was really good, inspiring. And you know, there was one time there was one guy that I didn't know it at the time, but another guy who was going to speak did know that one of those guys was actually thinking about committing suicide. The only time I've really heard about that or anybody doing that, but this one particular individual, and he gave a speech today that my buddy gave a little sermon that day about how blessed we were. And look around, you know, we've lost buddies. A lot of our buddies are on the battlefield. You know, we still got two hands, two eyes, you know, two legs. We're doing pretty good.
Here's another familiar face mm-hmm. to some people, depending on your age.
Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing to hear a POW say that. You know, I talk about one of the great things. I think there's a couple corners that you turn when you deal with trauma. One is understanding that other people probably have it worse off than you do, okay? And then two is getting to a place where you help other people. And when you hear guys who were in a POW camp telling each other that we have it pretty good, that's astounding, isn't it? Wow. Interesting stuff, that the way they the structure of life, you know, and I when I hear about the structure of the cell, that this senior guy, this lieutenant colonel, was relieved by a captain who told him, "You are not in charge anymore, and we're ordering you to reconcile yourself with the code of conduct." That structure was important to them. Compare and contrast that with the structure that young people get today. There isn't any. You know, a lot of parenting is do what you want, helicopter parents saving you from the consequences. And so what do you learn? You know, you certainly don't learn accountability. And they live that. They live that. But that structure was very, very important to them. Let me just tell you, I think this is fascinating, this glimpse into life in the Hanoi Hilton. And the other thing you see is Brian Lamb is a great, great interviewer.
From the 1992 campaign, this is right before that, mm-hmm. another one of your prisoners of war.
Okay.
As we've come along in this 20th century, we've become litigious. Is that the right word?
Litigious.
Society. Litigious.
Litigious.
Society.
This is Admiral James Stockdale.
Where we believe that somebody owes us an explanation and an apology and a payback if something is not quite right. And when you start talking about warriors last seen alive, never being, that the government owes you a blow-by-blow description of what happened to them to bring about either their demise or their missingness. There's never been a war in history that any government could do that. I mean, to say that the government owes us an explanation for what happened to a guy who was last seen alive out on the battlefield. I mean, can anybody see that as a possible reality?
Admiral Stockdale was Ross Perot's running mate in 1992. He was also a senior ranking officer mm-hmm. in the camps. He was a commander in the Navy. Mm-hmm. What did he do that was that showed leadership?
Well, at one period, he was a senior ranking officer in the Hanoi Hilton because Reisner was out of commission and out of the communication channel, and Stockdale was running the show. Reisner was over at the zoo at that time, I think.
And, where was the zoo?
The zoo was, that was the old film studio on the south side of town. It was another camp where a couple hundred guys were over there for quite a long time. It's a place where we had one of the major escapes, and guys were recaptured, and a lot of people were beaten and tortured after that. But back to Stockdale, they knew he was a big fish also. He was a senior naval officer there. And so they tortured him a number of times over and over. And they wanted him to make propaganda. They wanted him to make a propaganda movie. And he just set the policy again, like Reisner, same policy. You know, we're going to resist them. We're not going to collaborate with them. We're going to do our very best. And when they wanted to be in this movie, they gave him a razor to shave, and he cut a reverse mohawk in his hair and cut his scalp, and he was all bleeding and all. And they said, "You're not getting out of this movie." Remember, they had tortured him for this, so they put a cap on him and left him in a room with one of those little milking stools like I was talking about that we were supposed to sit on, and he took the milking stool and beat his face black and blue until it was all swollen, and they couldn't use him in the movie.
How much was...
Can you imagine? I don't know if everybody feels the same way, but to me, this is... The courage and selflessness of these guys in that environment with those, we'll put a cap on you. And he beats his own face to the point that he can't be in a movie. Wow.
Is he tortured?
A lot.
What impact did it have on him, and what kind of torture did they use?
Well, he was in the ropes, the pretzel, many times, which was probably one of the worst tortures, and he was beaten.
What do you mean by pretzel? Explain it.
The wrists are tied behind your back, or in cuffs, if you can imagine that, and then the elbows are tied. They would throw you on the ground and step on your elbows and put a loop over one and a loop over the other and just keep pulling them and pulling them until they made your elbows touch, which is an unnatural act.
Did that happen to you?
No. It didn't, but I'd say probably 40-50% of the guys it did. And then once those elbows are tied, one guy would, you know, they'd spin you around now, and one guy is behind you lifting up on your arms behind your back, and one guy's in front of you with his foot on your head, which is down between your legs, pulling that up, and they would cinch it up, your arms coming up over your head, and then tie you in that position, tie that to your feet maybe. It was a terrible, terrible...
How did people get through that?
Mental toughness, and you know, there was no way... I mean, they could make you do something. Stockdale, Reisner, all of them eventually would do something. They would eventually give in, is what I'm saying. There were no John Waynes. They could make you do something. So the deal was to go through torture to a point and then give in. You know, try to get them to back off, but they usually wouldn't. And then give in at a point where you still got your mental faculties that you can outsmart them. Because they're wanting something, but we were smart enough generally to deny them what they really wanted. We were going to give in before we ever really gave in. We were never going to give in and side with them.
What's the story of Lieutenant Paul Galante?
Paul Galante was a brilliant, innovative, great cellmate of mine for a long time. And before he got there a year before me. maybe a year and a half before me. So he had been through a lot of the old stuff that I hadn't been through back in 1966 and early 67. So he's a real veteran of that. But they were trying to do a propaganda thing with him, and they brought him into a cell. It was nice and well organized and everything, and so they were going to take a picture of him for propaganda purposes. And so he sat down on the end of his cell, and in order to kind of outsmart him and to show his defiance, he put both fingers down between his legs and gave him the bird. And that picture was taken by a German photographer, and I have a copy of that in my book. It was on the cover of Life magazine that year, but they had photoshopped the two birds, his fingers out.
And did he have any retribution after that?
I can't tell you. I've forgotten.
Let me ask
there
you.
There was always retribution if they figured it out. See, Denton blinked torture, and you can still see that. That's one of the most amazing things. That video of him, that when they tortured Denton, and he went to that press conference, and the communist reporter was interviewing him, and he was blinking Morse code torture. And it was the first time the U.S. government knew what was happening to us. They didn't know about that. They probably would have killed him. They probably would have tortured him to death, but they didn't catch on to that.
What do you find after all these years? And by the way, what have you done? How long did you stay in the service?
24 and a half years. I retired January of 1990.
What was your last rank?
Colonel, full colonel.
And what were you doing?
At that point, I was running, I'd run two leadership organizations, or I was the vice commandant of Squadron Officer School. So we had 800 officers going through an 8.5-week leadership officership course, 5 classes a year, and then I went to the University of Georgia, which is near my home. I wanted to go back and be with my parents. They were getting old, and they had sacrificed a lot for my Air Force career. So I went back to the University of Georgia and ran the ROTC program for 3.5 years, and that was a great experience. So my last two assignments in the Air Force after my flying career was over, and I had a great flying career after I came back, but my last two assignments were leadership development. So the last 16 or 17 years, I've been a leadership consultant. I have my own leadership consulting company, and that's why I worked to make the book focused toward leadership, because the leadership that we experienced in the Hanoi Hilton was so remarkable. We may never see this example of that much great leadership under such difficult circumstances again, certainly not in my lifetime.
How much do you find in this country that people know about the Vietnam War today?
Older people remember a lot. Younger people don't know a lot. It's just natural. They're looking forward and not back. And I think a lot of good things have come out. Finally, Vietnam veterans are getting some proper recognition, which they didn't get when they came home. The POWs did, but most Vietnam veterans got spit on, or they were afraid to wear their uniform because of the anti-war movement was so strong and so vulgar against them. But now I see a lot of welcome homes out there, and they are being accepted. And the interesting thing, Vietnam veterans have done very well. You know, we know there's some of them have been homeless and some of them had drug problems, but the average Vietnam vet has beat his peer group in the population in economic gains, economic success, marriage success, career success. In every way that you can measure, we've outperformed the general society.
How did you get your Air Force commission in the first place?
I'd always wanted to fly, and when I got in the University of Georgia, I got in the Air Force ROTC, and that was smooth sailing from then on.
I want to ask you about some of the names that you labeled your Vietnamese caretakers when you were in the POW camp. Dum Dum.
Yeah, that was one of the other guys who'd been there earlier than me named Dum Dum, because he was like a big brute, but he was dumb as dirt, and in the way he related to us. He may have been, I'm sure he had some intelligence, but in his relationship with us. You had to name people, you had to name places, like our cell blocks were named after Las Vegas casinos of the 60s. You have to name the guards so you can communicate who they are. Well, Dum Dum was just one of the guards.
Fat in the fire.
Fat in the fire. The first night I got to the Hanoi Hilton, they gave me a pair of black pajamas, had my first bath in 2 weeks in cold water in November, And I went in and sat down with a little stool beside these three other guys that had written on the truck with me. And this guy, in an immaculately fitting uniform, dress uniform, puts his arms up like this and looks around. And now, the fat is in the file. And that was my first words, and I heard in English, Nahanawa Hilton. I almost broke out laughing in his face. If it hadn't been such a scary situation, I would have, because it was this guy, as it turned out, he memorized American idioms, and he would throw them at us. He would come open our porthole and say, "Johnson, Johnson, between the devil and the deep blue sea," and slam it and leave, because he was President Johnson. So he was...
How often, by the way, would you take your waste pot, or it could be called a honey pot,
yeah,
and put it under the door?
Oh, just not very often. We did that a few times.
Explain what you did, though.
Yeah, we had this one guard that was really bugging us, and maybe more than one, a couple that would just come by and just, you know, they couldn't get to us because they didn't have a key. Only a turnkey had a key. They didn't trust a guard with a key. And they would just come by and yell at us and irritate us and call us names. You know, you could tell they were that kind of trash talking. Open our porthole and looking to do that. So one day, Jim, or I think it was Jim, said, "Hey, let's just pull, you know, we can handle it because we're accustomed to it. Let's just pull the lid off the honeypot and let it sit right under the door. So the next time he opens that door, he's going to get a snoot full of honeypot." And that worked. He opened that porthole and slammed it up and left.
Who was Sweet Pea?
Sweet Pea was our turnkey in the Hanoi Hilton. He was a good guy. He got busted once and got two stripes pulled away because there was another guy across the hall who looked a lot like me, had dark hairs about my height, and he brought him back from an interrogation one day and opened our door and shoved him in the door and slammed it and locked it and left. And he came back 3 or 4 hours later when it was time to feed us, and he looked in and he saw there was five guys in there and not four. He would moan. Sweet Pea would go, like that. And he grabbed him and put him across the hall the next day. I guess they had Communist Party camp meetings. It's like revival meetings, 3 nights a week on the other side of the wall, and we could hear them. And evidently, he went to that night, he confessed what he had done, because nobody would have ever known. He confessed, and he was missing some stripes.
Did any American POW haul off and pop one of these guards?
Yeah, one guy did, and he's a big kind of football player type guy from Air Force Academy, and they were messing with him, and he just hauled off and hit one, and they hit him on the back of the neck with a AK-47 rifle butt, and he had some serious long-term injuries from it.
Here's some video of somebody you might recognize coming back from the POW camps.
Yeah.
Recognize any of those people?
Yeah, I recognize them all. In fact, the guy on the right is the one that was across the hall they put in the ship. That guy looks familiar. About
that's you.
Yeah, once the agreements were signed, I started growing my mustache again, my fighter pilot mustache again. So
it's the eyebrows that were rather strong at that time.
Yeah, I've always had.
Now, where are you here?
This is at Clark Air Base. We just left the hospital. We're about to get on a C-141 and fly back home from the Philippines.
How much do you remember the details of those days?
I remember some things very well, and I'm sure there's a lot of things I don't remember at all.
You say you're not bitter.
No.
Were you ever bitter?
Yeah, I was. And while I was there, I mean, I hated them. I mainly hated communists because communism is built on a lie.
By the way, is this your family?
No, those are just people there that agree. We had no idea what kind of reception we were going to get. And all these people were there. A lot of them had worn our bracelets, which we didn't know anything about. But they just came out and they just wanted to hug us, and we just let them. You know, we hadn't seen any females in 5.5 years, 6 years, 7 years. So it was nice.
Yeah. So back to the bitterness thing. And have you been back?
I haven't, but I'm going in February, actually the first week of March. I'm going on a cruise. It's going from Hong Kong to Hanoi and Da Nang and Saigon. But the bitterness issue, I think, you remember I said that the last couple of years were more live and let live? think that was a time for us to decompress. And in a way, we wasted 2 years, but in a way it kind of gave us that opportunity. And I think we have probably much less PTSD. The fact that we came home physically and mentally as well as we did, a lot of that had to do with that last 2 years of live and let live, a little bit better food, better treatment, no torture. And during that time, we had time to think through, what are we going to be like when we go home? What's our future look like? And we were smart enough to know that bitterness would never hurt them. It would only hurt us. And it only takes that much of bitterness to ruin your life. Why should we go home in shackles to bitterness if we can go home really free? So we started just washing. It was like just layer and layer away of anger and bitterness. And I don't think any of us lost at all the anger, but I think most of the bitterness. So my issue is really with communism, because it's built upon an intellectual lie, and it can only exist where there's a gun.
So when you go back and that ship puts in at Hanoi, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I can go in like a tourist. I have the mental ability to turn off all emotion still when I need to, and unfortunately, and I could go in and be like a tourist. And I don't know if I'll do that, or if I'll just go in and just celebrate being free, or I have no idea what's going to happen yet.
What is located at the Wallo prison, the Hanoi Hilton area now?
I think there's a hotel there and some office buildings, and they have a small museum. That's what I hear. A lot of the guys have been back. They've been well received throughout Vietnam. They've had great experience going back. Some of my friends have been back 3 or 4 times, and they enjoy going back.
So here's one. When we were there in 92, we were very well treated by people, and they said a lot of nasty things about the Russians.
Oh, really?
How could it be that the Vietnamese people would greet us in a friendly way but have a negative impression of the Russians?
I think because Russians are Russians and Americans are Americans. We're naturally people who want to help people and be with them. Russians do too, but not communists. See, that's the difference. I think the Russians they've dealt with are generally the communist people.
Did you ever worry that you were killing human beings when you were dropping bombs on North Vietnam?
Not for long back then. You know, I'm a warrior, and it was war, and they were on one side and I was on the other. That's the bad thing about war.
How many of the 500 or so North Vietnamese American POWs, the ones that are in North Vietnam, are still alive today?
I would guess probably 65-70%. So if there were 400, let's say there were 400 of us there that were there 5 years or longer, you know, there's probably 280 of us still alive, maybe 300.
And how often do you see them?
Every 2 or 3 years. Some of them I see every year. Some of them I see every 2 or 3 years. Some of them I haven't seen at all in 20 or 30 years.
We're out of time, Lee Ellis. Former colonel in the United States Air Force. The book is called Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amazing. Amazing. The 4 people in a cell, 6 feet by 7 feet. Why aren't you bitter? And one of the reasons he says that the incidence of post-traumatic stress is so low is that the last 2 years of his captivity, they were all together and they had a chance to decompress as a group. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. I'm fascinated by the fact that that number's still so low. The and maybe it is. You know, maybe there's a lesson in that, you know. Anyway, thank you for listening here on a Thursday. The chef will join me tomorrow. It is Friday. My thanks to retired Marine Colonel Jerry Durant for coming on and talking about Iraq. Yeah, you know, when you hear him talk, first of all, the big tickets in Iraq, who's going to rebuild it? So if you want to throw in with Iran, guess what? Well, and you know, and here's the deal. Okay. Do you want peace? Yes. Are you willing to partition the country? No. Then you have to deal with the Sunnis. Unless you deal with the Sunnis, unless you either include them in the government, give them their own provincial government, and share revenue, you will never enjoy peace. You will always be in a state of war. Is that what you want? Or you can do the Arab strongman thing, which is kill them and persecute them, and in that case, you'll be at war forever. If you want to rebuild it, there's only one group that's that has the money to rebuild it, and that is the Western economic powers of the world. Unless you want China to come in here and you want to sign debt notes with China. Yeah, we don't want to do that. Okay. But there's no willingness to deal with the Sunnis. So, how does Iraq go forward? Jerry Durant offers you very little optimism based on his interactions with Iraqi Christians, Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites. And he goes over there, you know, he's stood up language schools and staff colleges for the Iraqi military. And so he's back and forth. Yeah, so there you have it. I guess more to follow. But until the Shiites who run the government in Iraq come to the conclusion that, one, we have to distance ourselves from Iran because we can't rebuild the country. Until we rebuild the country, even the western cities of Al-Anbar and Fallujah, we can't have peace. Until we offer those people some kind of economic hope, we can't have peace. And so we have to do that. Until they come to that conclusion, you're going to have what we have, which is not good. And again, the POW thing, the low incidence of post-traumatic stress in those guys, it's pretty amazing. Email. Mac, I think after listening to Colonel Ellis talk, I would certainly say that there's two primary factors. One is, as he said towards the end of the interview, the last 2 years weren't as difficult. They were allowed to be around each other, bond with each other, talk to each other, and help each other heal, and prepare to go home. Because they knew at some point they were going home. I also think that them being older and college educated had something to do with it. I think you're talking about guys who were 23, 24, 25 when they were shot down, many of them in their 30s when they came home. I think younger guys aren't as developed emotionally. Some of that group has structural flaws, to quote you. And whether we care to admit it or not, as he describes those last 2 years, they were very much administering to their own mental health needs. A 19-year-old Marine or soldier that goes and comes home and gets discharged gets none of that, and arguably is too young to handle it all. Thank you for playing the interview. Awesome stuff. I agree. Brian Lamb's a great interviewer. That'll do it on Thursday. Have a great afternoon. The Yankees play Houston here coming up in the next 20 minutes or so. So don't be afraid to go ahead and don't be afraid to check that event out. They beat Houston 4-0 last night. Yankees have a pitcher named Louis Severino, and he's He's pretty good. He's a young guy, and he's a pretty good pitcher. So threw a shutout last night, and their big hitter, Giancarlo Stanton, one of them, hit a big home run. So anyway, with all of that said, for all you baseball fans that are at work, don't be afraid to fire up your MLB package. Fire up your MLB package on your screen and shut the door. But, no, thanks for listening today here on All Marine Radio. The that's why buy the book. It's called Struggle Well. And begin to see that these guys from Vietnam who lived at the Hanoi Hilton, who endured that, right, they came home with 4%. Right, the rest of the inmate population had 30%. Right, so what are the lessons? Right, so skewing towards post-traumatic growth. Okay, it's not a disability. There's all kinds of people that experience trauma and go do great things in life. And there's no reason that the people you know can't be one of those people. There's no reason at all. Right, I think it starts one with education, and saying you can do it. You're going to live with it, right? But it's not going to disable you. It'll be something you live with. So, with that said, have a great afternoon. We'll see you tomorrow morning on a Thursday. All Marine Radio. Out.